The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Kyler Stern has rejected the assassin's life.
We've got a contract for you. 50,000 Gunders for one kill, Kyler. With that much, you can take Aline and Yuli anywhere. You'll have done the world a good turn, and you'll never have to work again. It's just one last job.
There's always one last job. I'm finished.
The God King's successful coup has left Kyler's master, Derzo Blint, dead and buried.
Oh, I've been having a little party, celebrating.
What are you celebrating?
Derzo Blint is dead!
Tired of it all, he is starting over. New city, new friends, and a new profession.
Kyler, there are always going to be people so bad that we think they deserve to die. I don't know. What I do know is what you've told me about what killing has done to your soul. No matter what good it seems to do for the world, it destroys you. I can't watch that, Kyler. I won't. I care about you too much.
All right. We should be able to leave in the morning.
But the beckoning will of the Shadow soon comes to call on Kyler once again.
Logan's alive. He's in the hall.
Logan's alive?
Every day, the chances that Logan will be discovered get worse.
You want me to break into the hole and save Logan?
I want you to rescue Logan. And then I want you to assassinate the God King.
Kyler is faced with an agonizing choice. Will he give up the Way of Shadows and live in peace? Or will he risk everything by taking on the ultimate hit?
Look at yourself! I know this hit is impossible! I'm sending you after a god! But if anyone in the world can do it, it's you! You were made for this, Kyler. Some things are bigger than your happiness. You can give hope to an entire nation!
It'll only cost me everything.
Will Kyler see the light when his world is shrouded in shadows? Find out in Shadow's Edge, the thrilling second part of the Night Angel trilogy. Available now in Graphic Audio.
It's good to have you back, my friend.
It's bad to be back.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man, 15, Power of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by James Lewis, Elizabeth Jernigan, Richard Rowan, Ren Casey, Nanette Savard, Tim Carlin, Terrence Aselford, Dylan Lynch, Joe Brack, MJ Casey, Ken Jackson, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Eric Messner, and Tony Penny.
Winter had poised to blow its way across the high lonesome. Most of the aspens had lost their leaves. Those that remained glowed in a riot of yellow and red. The maples and scrub oaks resisted stubbornly, greenness proclaiming their independence, dotted in among the less hardy trees. Smoke Jensen took a draw on the flavorful cigar and sent his gray gaze out across the vista of his beloved Sugarloaf Ranch, while the white ribbons rose from around the stove. It wouldn't be long, he figured, before a thick blanket of snow covered everything in sight, which reminded him of the letter he held in his hand. It had come from San Francisco that morning, brought by a ranch hand who had gone to Big Rock for the weekly mail run. Smoke cut his eyes to the brief message. Only a single line.
Come at once. Meet me at Francie's.
Because of where they were to meet and of whom he suspected as the sender, Smoke refrained from mentioning the cryptic message to his wife, Sally. That he would go went without question. Smoke Jensen lifted himself out of the cane-bottomed chair he had tilted back in against the outer wall of his home on the Sugar Loaf. Once a tight, square cabin of fir logs, and now sprawled with the additions brought on by a large family. He crossed to the door and entered. At once, his nostrils twitched and swelled to the delicious scent of a pie bacon. Drawn by that tempting aroma, he gained the kitchen with a broad grin on his face, his unpleasant mission forgotten for the moment.
It's the last of the blackberries. I thought you'd like it.
I know I will.
Bobby Jensen was sitting at the round oak table in the center of the expanded room.
I thought you were out with the hands.
I would have been, but I got this big old splinter when I went to wash up this morning.
You'll live.
Oh, I know that. It just stings, and my toe swelled up too much to put it in the boot.
Sally recognized the distracted expression Smoke wore and came right to the point.
There's something in that letter I don't know about.
I was coming to tell you. Maybe you ought to check out that pie and then get a cup of coffee and come sit at the table.
Bad news?
As always.
Smoke revealed the summons to San Francisco. When he concluded, Sally fought back her disappointment.
You're going, of course.
I have to, Sally. You know as well as I who probably sent that.
I've no doubt, and that always spells danger.
Danger for who?
For whom? Smoke, of course, but mostly for anyone who gets in his way.
Oh, you're going gunning for someone, huh, Smoke?
Most likely. Sally, make sure there's plenty of firewood and supplies laid in. Who knows when I'll be back? Then all I can think of is that you all bundle up tight for the winter.
Shortly after sunrise, Smoke Jensen fastened the last strap onto saddlebags and swung atop his Palouse stallion, Thunder. Now, as he turned his mount south toward the main gate of the ranch and the town of Big Rock beyond, Sally came from the back door, shawl over her shoulders to stave off the morning chill.
Always did have to have the last word, woman.
Goodbye, Smoke, dearest. Be careful.
You too. Keep your friend close at hand.
Mountain man instincts, imbued in him by his mentor Preacher, some were starting to call, rightly or not, the first mountain man, alerted Smoke Jensen to the presence of others, even before Thunder twitched his big black ears and swiveled him forward to listen down the trail. 5 minutes later, two young men rode into view. They had the look about them of ranch hands, and an air of that wandering fraternity loosely described as drifters. Smoke Jensen noted that their clothing was a cut above average. They wore their hats at a jaunty angle and rode easy in the saddle.
Getting close to winter, Buck.
Yeah, sure is, Jason. I sure hope there's a spread out here somewhere that'll take us on for the winter. Be dang cold trying to get by on our own.
No fooling, Buck. You know I hear there's some old cabins here about. Janie's put up by the fur traders. We can settle down in one of them.
What are we going to use to buy supplies?
I reckon that's why we should find us a place and earn some cash money.
Don't know moss grow on you, Jace.
That decided Smoke. He led Thunder by the headstall onto the trail.
Hey!
Shit! You ain't going to rob us, is you, mister?
No, nothing like that. I overheard you talking about looking for work. As it happens, I could use a couple of hands right now. I can't take you there and introduce you around. I'll write you a note. Take it to Cole Travis, my winter foreman, and to my wife, Sally.
Why, well, that's mighty generous of you, Mr.
The name's Jensen.
All right, Mr. Jensen. We're obliged. I'm Buck Jarvis, and this is Jason Rucker. We'll work hard for you, that I promise.
I know you boys will. The Sugarloaf is 10 miles up this trail in a large highland valley. You'll make it about in time for dinner. Walk your horses slow. Takes time to get them accustomed to the altitude.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. You'll not regret this.
Fine, boys. Let me do that note.
In Big Rock, Smoke Jensen had a 3-hour wait for the DNRG daily train to the Union Pacific Junction. He left Thunder to be loaded on a stock car and walked down Main Street to the sheriff's office.
Don't you ever do any work.
Dang it now, Smoke Jensen. What the devil you mean sneaking up on a body like that?
Monty, you never change. I'm on my way to San Francisco. Thought I'd stop by and let you know I'll be gone from the Sugarloaf.
Glad you did. I've been hoping for an excuse to go after a cup of coffee with a shot of rye in it. Let's go down to the gold field.
Might as well. I got a 3-hour wait.
Like I said, this country's getting downright tame.
Yep. Funny thing, I was just thinking the same thing.
Used to be, with wild fights. Now I don't bust ahead of more than one rowdy drunk a week.
You're complaining, Monty.
Well, I'm not saying that I object all that much. Bruises take longer to heal at my age. Caught me a winner of a shiner 3 weeks ago. Last of the yellow and green faded out yesterday.
What we got here?
Couple of old farts hogging the street, I'd say.
You be right, Rube.
If you're looking for a lesson, I'd be glad to oblige.
No need for that, old hoss. Remember, you have a train to catch in less than 3 hours.
Did you hear that? His daughter and idiot's calling you out.
There'll be no gunfighting.
Oh, yeah? You insulted me, and I'm not gonna let you get away with it, old man.
Smoke cut his eyes to Monty.
I don't see as how there's much you can do about it. My friend and I simply will not draw.
Then what say we pound you into the ground like a fence pole?
What say you shut the fuck up?
Whoa! Why, you son of a bitch! I'm gonna fucking kill you!
Why, you bastard, you can't do that!
You know what I can do?
What?
I kick your ass.
That's enough, Smoke.
Whoa! Oh! Well, what'd you call him?
Smoke. His name is Smoke Jensen.
Oh, God, please, Mr. Jensen, please don't kill us.
I didn't start this.
I know. Only we was just fun, and please spare us, Mr. Jensen. I know who you are.
Obviously. Too bad you didn't before you started this.
We didn't mean you no harm, Mr. Jensen.
It sure as thunder didn't look like it.
I should like to tee you up till you get sober.
Who are you, the marshal?
No, I'm Sheriff Monte Carson. Hence the badge, dipshit.
Oh, Jesus, now I know we're dead.
Like I said, I should lock you up. But I figure you've had enough punishment for one day. Now get your partners on their horses and get the hell out of Big Rock. You have a quarter hour.
Yes, sir. Oh, yes, sir. Go.
Wow. I've seen horses more intelligent than those two bastards.
You know you're gonna miss this place, Smoke.
Yeah. Though I've heard San Francisco has its share of assholes that I'll probably get a chance to stomp on.
Out in California, in the gold fields on the Sacramento River, a miner worked his claim alone under the shade of huge, ancient live oaks. A crafty man and a proficient prospector, Ray Wagner had forged higher up the river than those who had been attracted by the magnet of the Sutter's Mill discovery more than 30 years before. Logic and a basic knowledge of physics told him that the gold farther down had to have a source higher up. As a result, he had a prosperous claim that produced threefold what the next most productive outfit took from the river. He had just dumped a shovel load of mud and gravel into his riffle box sluice when he sensed the presence of others. Always a cautious man, Wagner had a bulky, superbly made 10mm Mauser tucked in the waistband of his trousers. He set the shovel aside, and instead of reaching for the gold pan to work the findings, he put his long, strong fingers around the parrot-billed butt of the revolver. Then he turned to confront his uninvited guests.
Won't be no need for that, mister.
I didn't hear you howdy my claim.
Well, we did. Likely you didn't hear us for the water rushing through that sluice. If you be Raymond Wagner, we have something important for you.
Yeah, I am.
A runty man produced a sheaf of documents in a stiff blue paper legal binder.
These are for you. All you need to do is sign where the X marks are.
Suspicious, Wagner didn't reach for the papers, but kept his grip on his Mauser.
What is it I'm signing?
No need to read through them. Just sign.
I never sign anything I haven't read.
All right. Take them and read.
Wagner reached left-handed and took the documents. He quickly learned that they were a quitclaim deed and a transfer of title for his claim. His thin lips hardened into a stubborn line. Tethering his anger, he pushed the papers back toward the former Cornishman.
I will not sign these. I do not wish to leave this place or give up my gold find.
You really don't have a choice. Now, sign them like a good boy, pack up and be on your way.
And what am I to be paid for my claim?
Paid? Why, with the enjoyment of the rest of your life.
That brought the Mauser out with respectable speed.
Unglücklicher Bastarben! Get off my claim, you miserable bastards! I will give you 2 minutes to get out of sight!
Shaken with rage, the runty one stalked to his horse and mounted.
We'll be back. And when we come, you'll regret this.
I think not. Now move! Or be buried here!
Smoke Jensen got up from the table considerably better off than when he had taken a seat some 2 hours earlier.
Thank you, gentlemen, for an entertaining evening.
With that, he departed the smoking car of the Union Pacific Daylight Flyer, westbound for California. Two younger men, by the names of Billy and Teddy, watched Smoke exit the car. They had lost a substantial sum that evening and were sure that Smoke had cheated them. Quickly decided that they were going to confront Smoke and ask him about all his good luck. Billy and Teddy caught up with Smoke on the platform between the parlor car, behind the smoker and the Pullman beyond that.
Hold it right there, Jensen!
Smoke risked a quick look over one shoulder and noted that both had weapons in hand.
What seems to be the problem?
You cheated! And we want our money back!
Sorry. I don't cheat, and you don't get anything back.
You think because we're young we'll bluff easy? You don't even know who we are!
Two boys in way over their heads, I'd say.
We're danger! We're the biggest, meanest, smartest rustler gang in Wyoming, Colorado, and Kansas! That's who we are!
Frankly, I think you're full of crap. Grow up, sonny. Take your loss like a man.
And we'll take it from you if we have to kill you to do it!
Never make it, sonny.
God damn you, Jensen!
Smoke's .45 Colt Peacemaker appeared in his right fist as though by magic. Half a heartbeat later, a wide-eyed, badly shaken conductor arrived.
Oh my God, what happened here?
These dumbasses tried to kill me.
But why?
They figured to rob me.
Not on my train.
That's how I saw it, too.
This is terrible. Simply terrible. All this mess and the passengers, what would we do about them?
Well, we could spare them the awful sight.
How's that?
We could simply dump this garbage off the train.
Oh, no, we could never do that. There will have to be an inquiry into the shooting.
Well, then you deal with it. I'm going inside. Shooting people makes me thirsty.
Early morning reached San Francisco in a pink haze. Starlings twittered in the cornices of the public buildings off Market Street. Pigeons cooed indignantly at this invasion by their smaller, sleek cousins. On the wide front porch of his splendid home on Knob Hill, Cyrus Murchison gave his wife a buss on her peaches and cream cheek.
I'll be late tonight, Agatha, my dear.
Oh, Cyrus, you've been working so hard lately. Can't anyone else run that railroad of yours?
Yes, and there are a lot of them doing that day and night. This is other business.
You're seeing Titus and Gaylord again.
But they are my friends. They're also my only peers in commerce and industry.
Empire building, you mean?
Murchison brushed vacantly at the thick gold watch chain that hung in twin loops from the pockets of his dark navy pinstriped vest. Grown portly from good living, he had the florid face to go with the rich diet and ample spirits he consumed. In his early 50s now, he had a layer of fat right under his skin that gave him the youthful appearance of a man 10 years his junior. Often hailed in the pages of the San Francisco Chronicle as a captain of industry, Murchison had reached the pinnacle of his enterprise through hard, if often dishonest, effort. His sole weakness was his relationship with his wife. Put frankly, Agatha terrified him. One of her looks, a gesture, or a soft deprecating word could swiftly unman him. While he was a tyrant to every subordinate and lived a life like an autocrat, Cyrus Murchison quailed at the mildest rebuke from the woman he adored above all things save power. Now he shot a quick look over his shoulder. His carriage, complete with livery driver, waited to take him to his office.
Well, be that as it may, my dear, but this meeting is important. Tell Cook not to hold supper.
Seated in the brougham, Cyrus Murchison mentally reviewed the events of the past few days. Gaylord Huntley was a fool to believe that he could use those people and get out of it unaffected. They'd invented the squeeze, but they need them. Not all of the employees in their various enterprises could be corrupted. Another thing rankled even more. So they let that sourdough run them off, huh? One man against three, and not a one had had the forethought or fortitude enough to force him to sign. Next time, it might be well to have Tyrone Beale take charge of gaining that mining property. Stubborn man, that Raymond Wagner. German and blockhead. Titus Hobson simply had no idea of how to properly delegate authority. He made his way to the top in the gold fields by himself and never learned how to rely on the judgment and performance of other men. On the other hand, Murchison mused, he had learned that lesson early in the building of his California Central Railroad empire. He would have some hot words for his companions that evening. An early riser by habit from his time in the gold fields of Central California, Titus Hobson already sat at his desk. Although he was a good 5 years older than Cyrus Murchison, he retained powerful shoulders and arms from his years of working at mining and prospecting. Every bit as rich as Murchison, he remained a bit rough around the edges. His clothes might be of the best cloth and perfectly fitted, but they lost their luster on his burly frame. He eased himself forward in the leather-bound swivel chair to gaze down on San Francisco from his office on the fourth floor of the Flatiron Building. His eyes settled on the oddly peaked roofs of Chinatown. A smile played across his craggy face and set his bushy brows to waggling. This thing with the Chinese, he liked it. Yes. Let those little yellow devils take the lumps, if indeed any were to be handed out. Would they take orders from a white man? They should. Thousands of them had labored on Cyrus's railroad. They would settle the Chinese question tonight. Cyrus still had to be brought around. Gaylord had convinced him yesterday. It was up to the two of them to sway Cyrus. He smacked a hard hand on the glowing mahogany desktop.
Oh, hell, we should be able to handle this ourselves.
Hobson picked up the report once more. Neat rows numbers ran down the page in columns. Looking at him irritated him. He could read and write, he taught himself after he'd made that big strike on Russia's mountain. And he could do his figures right enough, too. Only this many numbers tended to blend together into a single indecipherable mass. This accountant of Cyrus's was right. They were all going to become a whole lot richer than their wildest dreams. Gaylord Huntley stepped cat-footed up to the bull-necked bruiser who stood defiantly in the gateway of Pier 7. Gigantic longshoreman held a cargo hook in one huge fist and a wicked filleting knife in the other. He seemed not the least intimidated by the presence of the overlord of all San Francisco dock workers.
When I say you don't work these docks, I mean you are out, even in times of emergency. Now, get your butt out of my sight.
You're not throwing me out, Huntley. I come to work and I aim to finish it.
Lightning fast, Huntley's ham fist flashed from his side and cracked into the center of the longshoreman's chest.
Bah! Ah!
Huntley pulled out his pistol. An evil look on his face.
Dump this trash in the bay.
The other dock workers hurried to comply. All of them had long ago been intimidated by this ferret-faced man with the bulging shoulders and arms of their trade. Gaylord Huntley's oily black hair slicked straight back on his elongated neck, added to the radique visage created by the black close-set eyes and protruding yellow teeth. Seen from behind, Huntley's stature was laughable. Some few had actually made the mistake of laughing. His oversized upper torso dwindled rapidly to a narrow waist and short legs planted on small feet. It gave him the appearance of a soaked wharf rat. Those who had sniggered at that sight had paid for it painfully. Not a few had paid with their lives. Huntley did not waste time on watching the disposal. He reholstered his Colt and turned from the dock. His mind went at once to the meeting with Cyrus and Titus. Over dinner, they would settle the idea of using the Chinese instead of his longshoremen or Cyrus's railroad detectives to enforce their will. That had been his idea. He considered himself to be a remarkable judge of the abilities and the reliability of other men. He found Zhang Li to be capable and trustworthy, if a little full of himself. He believed he had sold Titus on it the previous day. Only Murchison objected strongly. Perhaps that could be changed. He smiled in anticipation as he entered his office.
Ah, my dear Millie.
Huntley greeted the young woman seated in a comfortable chair beside a large potted palm.
Won't you come in, please? I have need of your special talents.
Killing always made him hunger for a woman's charms. Three men met the 11 o'clock local of the California Central when it rolled into Parkerville, California. Their leader, bandy-legged one who had confronted Ray Wagner, wore a surly expression and spoke with false bravado.
Whoever the boss is sending had better be in the mood to take orders.
But didn't that telegram from San Francisco say he was being charged?
Button that lip, Quint. I'm the boss round here, and this sissy city dude had better know it.
The first to bound down the folding iron steps was a huge burly man with flame red hair and a big walrus mustache that drooped around thick, tobacco-stained lips. He had a saddle slung over one massive shoulder that made the rig look tiny. It became obvious that he couldn't be someone for whom any of those delicate women and small children waited. He made a quick study of those on the platform and walked directly to the trio.
You must be Spencer. I'm Beale. Get me a horse.
Yes, sir. Right away.
Tyrone Beale had arrived. Cyrus Murchison had chosen well. Beale led a company of 25 railroad detectives under the direct orders of his boss, Hector Grange, chief of railroad police for the California Central. Always big for his age, Beale had killed his first man at the age of 13, beating him to death with his fists. The man was his stepfather. Brute and a drunk who had alternately beat his stepchildren and his wife. The authorities sent Tyrone Beale to a school for errant boys for 6 months while the family moved to another county. Then Beale was released. Since that time, he had never let anyone back him down. Never. No two-bit gold chaser was about to be the first. He had heard of the failure of Spencer and his underlings. Taken an axe handle to the stupid damn German and beaten some sense into him. He privately gave himself 10 minutes to convince Wagner. He dismissed this as he studied the two henchmen who accompanied Spencer.
Can either of you count to 20 without taking off your boots?
What's that mean?
I gather that means no. Now get this straight. I don't like to repeat myself. You're gonna take me out to this Wagner claim and we're gonna get his signature. There will be no failure. Is that clear?
They nodded their heads dumbly. Spencer returned then and took in the display. Anger rose again. He stomped over and put his face up in that of Tyrone Beale.
Those are my men. They take their orders from me.
Not anymore. Now saddle my horse and let's head for that claim.
You can go to hell, fucker. Come on, boys. We're out of this. Let the big man handle it himself. No!
When I give an order, it is obeyed.
Beale turned on one heel and started for the tie rail at one end of the station. Spencer's underlings followed him, gaping. Sally Jensen stood in the shade of the porch roof. Small fists on hips, she looked across the yard at the hands gathered near the break in corral. Young Bobby had crowded in among them. Ordinarily, that would not trouble her, but of late, that boy had taken to the newcomers as his idols. It wasn't often that Sally questioned the judgment of her husband. In his life of enforced caution, however, Smoke sometimes had made bad judgments about people. Sally had recently begun to hold a mild distrust toward the drifter Smoke had sent with that note. At least he'd be in San Francisco the next day and she would know where to contact him. Only thing, would she pass on her distress to worry him? He might think her taken with old maidish vapors. Just then, she saw some commotion over by the ranch hands. Bobby Jensen had climbed over the top rail and made for a particularly fractious young stallion who stood splay-legged at the tie rail. Foam flecked its black lips and hung in strings nearly to the ground. Its buckskin hide glistened with sweat, and its bellows chest heaved from exertion. So far, he had dumped three hands. A sharp pang of concern shot through Sally, and she hoisted her skirts to make room for her boots to fly faster.
Bobby! Bobby, don't you dare get on that horse!
Most of the hands, the old-timers, turned to look and said nothing. Buck and Jay sneered, and Buck turned his head to shout encouragement to the boy.
Go on, Bobby, you know you can do it!
That's enough! If that boy gets on that horse, you can pick up your time as of now!
Oh, come on, Miss Jensen. You're gonna make a sissy out of him.
Cole, you hear me? I mean what I say. If Bobby gets on that horse, you throw them off the Sugarloaf.
An uncomfortable silence followed, in which Sally reached the cluster of hands at the corral. Buck would not meet her eye. Jace turned his back insolently. Sally marched to the gate, slid the bar, and entered. She raised an imperious hand toward the lad who stood before her, the pain of humiliation written on his face.
Come on out here, Bobby.
But I can ride him. I know I can.
I'm not going to argue with you. Come with me.
Oh, please. He's worn down some now. Oh, at least let me try.
Not another word. Come along.
Outside the corral again, with Bobby in tow, Sally had the first pang of regret as she looked at his miserable expression. Huge, fat tears welled up and threatened to spill down his face. She knew that she had done right. But then another part of her mind mocked her.
How would Smoke have handled that?
Smoke Jensen, who'd been snoozing, tipped up the brim of his hat and gazed out the window of the Pullman car. A row of weathered gray shanties, shacks actually, lined the twin tracks. A gaggle of barefoot, shirtless boys of roughly 8 to 10 years old made impudent gestures to the passengers as the train rolled past their squalid homes. How different from youngsters in the High Lonesome. There, they would be clean as Sunday to meeting clothes, bundled up to their ears in coats and scarves and in rabbit-lined fur moccasins or boots to protect them from the cold. Already the car felt warm after their descent from the low coaster. Gradually, speed drained off the creaking, swaying coaches. Now, grim factories and warehouses took the place of the shacks. No doubt those youngsters' fathers toiled in these places. How could any man labor day after day with only light from windows too high up to see out of and only dingy inner walls to look at? How could they stand it? Smoke roused himself and retrieved his saddlebags from a rack overhead. At night, the same rack served as a frame for the fold-down bed that he had occupied for 2 nights. Not the most comfortable arrangement, Smoke acknowledged, but it beat the daylights out of a chair car. The trip back east with Sally several years ago had spoiled him. They had ridden in luxury in the private car of the president of the Denver and Rio Grande. They had their own room and a big soft bed that didn't even creak when they made love. Now that was the way to travel. Until man learned to fly, and that's a foolish notion, Smoke would prefer the pleasures of a private car for long-distance journeys. Smoke walked down the aisle to the open vestibule door and outside to descend from the train. He had a short wait while the crew positioned a ramp and opened the stock car. A vague hunger gnawed him, so so Smoke availed himself of a large fat tamale from a vendor with a large white box fitted on the front of a bicycle. The thick cornmeal roll was stuffed with a generous portion of shredded beef and lots of spices, including chili peppers, Smoke soon found out. Mouth afire, Smoke rigidly controlled his reaction, determined not to give the Mexican peddler the satisfaction of seeing a gringo suffer. 10 minutes later, as Smoke finished the last bite of the savory treat, a train man walked Thunder down the ramp. Smoke took the reins from the man, tightened the cinch strap, and adjusted his saddlebags, tying them in place with the Tego strips. Then he swung into the saddle and rode off toward the far side of town. Narrow, steep streets thronged with people made up the hilly city of San Francisco. Horse-drawn streetcars clanged noisily to scatter pedestrians from the center of the thoroughfares. Smoke Jensen steered his mount through the crowds with a common hand, ready to pat the trembling neck that showed the creature's dislike of close places and milling noisy humanity.
Easy, boy, easy. Use your best manners. We'll be out here soon.
The center of town consisted of tall buildings, 4 and 5 stories each, like red brick and wooden canyon walls. Even Smoke Jensen felt hemmed in. Too many people in far too little space. Past the Opera House, marquee emblazoned with bold black letters.
Tonight, Madame Schumann Hinke.
Whoever she was, she must be important, Smoke thought. Those letters were big. Beyond the commercial district, which appeared to be growing with all the frenzy of a drowned-out anthill, tenements stood in rows, rising to small duplexes and single-family dwellings. Smoke found the street he sought and began to climb another hill. This one was wider and led to a promontory that overlooked the bay. The higher he went, the better the quality of the houses. At last, he came to an opulent residence that had a spectacular view of the Golden Gate, as the harbor was being called lately. Tall mast billowed with wide bellies, a stately swift clipper ship sailed toward port, a snowy bone in her teeth so large it could be seen from Smoke's vantage point. He watched her for a while, captivated by her grace. Then he nudged Thunder and rode on to his destination. When he got there, his instincts kicked in and his hackles rose. Smoke cast a guarded gaze from side to side and along the street. What roused his sixth sense was the sight of a black mourning wreath. It hung below the oval etched glass portion of the large front door of the stately mansion. He slowed Thunder and eased off the safety thong on the hammer of his right-hand Colt. When he reached the wide curving drive, he halted and looked all around. Smoke could feel eyes on him, some from inside the mansion, others from hidden places along the avenue. A cast-iron statue of a uniformed jockey stood at the edge of a portico. Smoke reined in there, dismounted, and looped his reins through the rings in the metallic boy's upraised hand. 4 long strides brought him to the door. A brass knocker shone from the right-hand panel. Smoke could barely reach for it when the door opened.
We are closed. Can't you see the wreath?
I'm not, a client. Smoke Jensen, here to see Miss Francie.
Miss Francie? She's dead, sir.
What? When? What happened?
Well, we're not supposed to talk about it, the police said. Miss Lucy, she's in charge now. Do you wish to talk to her?
Yes, of course.
Smoke followed the woman into the unfamiliar hallway. Although Smoke had known of the place and known Francie DeLong for years, he had never visited the extravagant bordello. The housekeeper directed the way to a large, airy room, darkened now by the drawn drapes. A large bar occupied one long wall, a cut crystal mirror behind it. Comfortable chairs and burgundy velvet upholstery surrounded small white tables.
Wait here, if you will, Mr. Jensen. Miss Lucy will join you shortly.
Thank you.
Lucy arrived a few minutes later. She wore a high-necked black dress set off with a modest display of fine white lace. Her eyes, red and puffy from crying, went wide when she took in the visitor.
You have to be Smoke Jensen. Francis spoke so highly of you.
Miss Lucy, I'm sorry. Didn't know something had happened to Francie. Was she sick for long?
It wasn't sickness. She was run down by a stolen carriage.
Must have been terrible for you. For all the girls. When did it happen?
3 days ago. It was a foggy day. Francie went out to see her banker. She never came back.
I received a note saying someone would meet me here.
I don't know anything about that. I'm sorry.
We'll wait here a while then.
Oh, we cannot. There's to be a reading of Francie's will at 12:30. I'm to be there, and you are expected too. I sent you a telegram when I learned. We barely have time to get there as it is.
I still want to confirm who wrote me to meet him here.
I'll leave word with Ophelia as to where we'll be.
Your housekeeper?
Yes. All the girls are to be at the reading of the will.
Let me write a little note.
Smoke took a paper, a pen, and an inkwell from behind the bar. Smoke wrote briefly, then he gave it to Ophelia and turned to Lucy.
How are you getting to this?
We have a carriage. You're welcome to come along.
I have my horse outside. I'll accompany you.
I'll be relieved if you do. Something doesn't seem right about the way Francie died. It would feel nice to have a strong man around. We'll meet you on the drive.
Raymond Wagner looked up from his study of the flake gold and several rice-sized nuggets he had retrieved from his sluice. The splash and rumble of water racing down the riffles and screens of his sluice box had masked the sound of hoofbeats. He stared now into the ugly, passive faces of the three men whom he had run off his claim not 4 days ago. They had another one with them. This time, it was he who came forward and thrust the deed for him to sign.
Sign this!
I told them fellas I would not, and I say the same to you. Get off my claim.
Sign it and save us a lot of trouble.
Kenzie to hurry!
Go to hell, huh? Well, I tried to be nice.
With that, he whipped the pick handle off his left shoulder and swung it at Wagner's head.
We'll be back once you've healed enough to sign this deed.
Without another word, they left. Raymond Wagner lay on his side again, shivered in agony. Slowly, the world dimmed around them. Buck Jarvis and Jason Rocker looked up from the generous slabs of pie on their noon dinner plates. They fixed long, hungry, speculative looks on Sally Jensen as she distributed more of one of her famous pastries to the other hands. Only 4 days, and Sally had grown to dislike them intensely. Forcing herself to ignore their lascivious stares, she turned away.
I wonder what her body looks like under that dress.
I wonder what it would look like without a dress.
I bet them legs go on forever.
Oh, shoot, man. She's too old for you.
I'm willing to find out some of them older women's the best ride you can get. They appreciate it more.
You be blowing smoke, Jason.
I am not. My papa told me that when I was a young'un.
Well, neither one of us will get a chance to find out. You can be sure of that.
Smoke Jensen had half the hall yet to cover when a loud pounding came on the door. Ophelia materialized out of a small drawing room and beat Smoke to the entrance. Brian Pullen had his office over the Bank of Commerce on Republic Street. Smoke Jensen was able to tie up at a public water trough, which Thunder appreciated. The ladies had to place their oversized vehicle in a lot next door to the bank. Smoke walked there and escorted them to the outside staircase that led to the mayor's office. The sight of all those painted ladies turned more than a few heads. Rising from behind a cluttered desk, Brian Pullen extended a hand in greeting.
You must be Mr. Jensen. Lucy, ladies, I'll send my law clerk for more chairs. Please, make yourself at home.
The lawyer turned out to be younger than Smoke had expected. His well-made and stylishly cut suit showed his prosperity without being ostentatious. Pullen wore his sandy blonde hair in a part down the middle. Not one to make snap judgments, Smoke Jensen found himself liking the youthful attorney anyway.
There is another gentleman expected, though he appears to be late. We'll give him until 1 o'clock.
They passed the time in small talk. Pullen made an effort to draw Smoke out about his circumstances.
I understand you are in ranching.
Horse breeding. I have a good strong line of quarter horses, and another of Palouse horses.
Weren't they first bred by Indians?
Yeah, Mr. Pullen. The Nez Perce.
Please, call me Brian. I'm not old enough to be called Mr. Pullen. You're in Montana or Colorado, is it?
Colorado, Brian.
Pullen frowned and checked his big turnip watch. These short answers weren't getting him anywhere. If only the other man would arrive so they could get on with the reading of the will, he'd give it one more try.
You've been a lawman, is that right?
Yes, off and on.
On the frontier?
Of course.
I suppose you have some exciting tales to tell.
Nah, nothing much to tell. At least not in mixed company. Blood and violence tends to upset the ladies.
Fascinating. Thanks for the veritable cornucopia of information. Well, it's the witching hour, you might say. I don't believe we can delay any longer. Very well, then, let's proceed. We are here for the reading of the last will and testament of Frances DeLong. As her attorney, I am well aware of the contents and feel she exercised excellent judgment in the disposal of her estate.
Pullen paused and opened a folded document. From a vest pocket, he produced a pair of half glasses and perched them on his generous patrician nose. Then he began to read in a formal tone.
I, Frances DeLong, being of sound mind and body, do hereby bequeath all my worldly possessions as follows. To my dear friends at the San Francisco Home for Abandoned Cats, the sum of $1,000. To my faithful employees...
Here, Brian Pullen read off the names.
I leave the sum of $500 each. To my ever-faithful assistant, Lucy Glover, I leave in perpetuity the revenue from the saloon bar at my establishment. All my other property, liquid assets, and worldly goods I leave to the man who once saved my life, Kirby Jensen. This was dated and signed 6 months ago.
Smoke had always hated his first name, and he hadn't used it except under the utmost necessity for many years, so the shock and import of what the lawyer read did not strike him at first, not until the door opened.
What do you think of being the proprietor of the most elaborate sporting house in San Francisco, mon ami?
Just as he had expected, Louis Longmont, his old friend and fellow gunfighter, stood in the door frame with a broad grin on his face. Smoke came to his boots quickly and crossed the short space. Both men gave one another a back-slapping embrace.
I thought it was you who sent that mysterious message. Now tell me about it.
I will, mon ami, but not here or now. We need some place to be alone for what I have to say.
Sally Jensen stood over the boys seated at the kitchen table. Bobby had his face turned up to hers, though he would not meet her eyes. Not 10 minutes ago, Sally had caught the 12-year-old behind the big hay barn, a hand made quirly in his lips, head wreathed in white tobacco smoke. Now, rather than the hangdog expression of shame, his face registered defiance. His explanation of the smoking incident had shocked and angered Sally.
Buck made it for me. Jason said I was big enough to take up smoking.
This morning, they had both remained in the bunkhouse, claiming sickness when the hands had ridden out to check the prize horses on graze in the west pasture. Not long ago, they had come out and moseyed around the barnyard. Bobby, who'd been laid up with his bunged-up toe since 3 days ago, had joined them. Three of them had gone around behind the barn. Sally, at work in the kitchen sink, had kept an eye on the barn, wondering what they might be doing. When enough time had passed to arouse her suspicions, she wiped her hands on her apron and walked out to check on them. She had found Bobby alone, smoking a cigarette. She descended on him in a rush and snatched the weed from his mouth. Crushing it with a slender boot toe, she had demanded to know what he thought he was doing. His explanation only increased her pique.
Well, Buck Jarvis and Jason Rucker are neither your mother nor your father. Smoke would have a fit if he knew what you've done. Come with me into the kitchen.
Does it mean you're not going to tell Smoke? You know, what you said, that he would have a fit if he knew what I had done?
I am disappointed in you, Bobby. I don't know now if I will tell Smoke or not, but you are staying inside for the rest of the day, young man.
Oh, Miss... Mom, I feel okay now. No more sore toe. Please let me eat with the hands. It's going on noon anyhow.
All right. But you stay away from Buck and Jason, hear?
Yes, ma'am.
You may go to your room now.
Yes, ma'am.
Feet dragging, Bobby headed for the staircase that led to the second floor bedrooms. Although he ordinarily slept in the bunkhouse with the hands, since the arrival of Buck and Jason, Sally had insisted that Bobby return to his room in the main house. Something about him made her mighty uncomfortable. She had good reason to recall that when the hands arrived at noon. Buck and Jason joined them. The two drifters stuffed themselves and begged off work on the pretext that they still ailed a mite. After the hands rode off and Bobby came back inside, they lounged around on a bench outside the bunkhouse. When she went outside to hang up a small wash, they gave her decidedly lascivious looks. Aware of that, Sally thought to herself it was a good damn thing she was not entirely alone. Dinner for Smoke and Louis Longmont was at the Chez Paris on the waterfront near the huge pier that people were already calling Fisherman's Wharf. Fancy eating place catered to San Francisco's wealthy and near wealthy. White linen cloths covered the tables, their snowy expanses covered with matching napkins and silver rings, heavy silverware and tall, sparkling candle holders, complete with chalky candles. Thick maroon velvet drapes framed the tall windows, each foot square pane sparkling from frequent cleaning. Paintings adorned the walls, along with sconces with more tapers flickering in the current sent up by scurrying waiters. The staff wore black trousers and short white jackets under brilliant lace front shirts and obsidian bow ties. The maitre d' was formally attired in tails. He led Smoke and the New Orleans gunfighter to a table in an alcove. Seated, they ordered good rye. While it was being fetched, Louis perused the menu.
I'll order for us both, if you don't mind, Smoke.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
When the waiter returned with their drinks on a silver tray, Louis was ready to order.
We'll start with the escargot. Then?
He went on to order a regular feast after that. He added appropriate wines for each course and sat back to enjoy his whiskey. After an appreciative sip, he inclined his long, slim torso towards Smoke, seated across from him.
You are no doubt wondering why I so summarily summoned you here, no?
I will admit to some curiosity.
Francie was still alive when I sent that letter. It's not about her rather unusual demise. Something is afoot among the big power brokers of Northern and Central California. There are rumors of a secret cabal recently formed that includes Cyrus Murchison, the railroad mogul, Titus Hobson, the mining magnate, and Gaylord Huntley, the shipping king.
That's some big guns, right enough. Murchison is the biggest fish, of course. Even in Colorado, we've heard of his doings in the newspapers.
Well, yes. Word is that they are out to establish a monopoly on all transportation and gold mining. But that's not all, Monami. Phase two of their scheme, I have learned since coming to San Francisco, is to then go after title to all of the land in private hands.
They'll strangle out all the small farmers and shop owners with outrageous shipping rates by rail, water, freighting company.
Part of it, too, is to take control of all forms of entertainment, theater, saloons, and bordellos.
Not too unusual for captains of commerce. I bet they're ambitious, but I'd wager any group of powerful men might seek to eliminate competition.
Quite true. Yet this is no ordinary power play. The cabal is supposed to have made an unholy alliance, which has prompted me to seek your help. Murchison and company are believed to have made an accommodation with the dreaded Triad Society. The Tongs of Chinatown.
Of course I'll help, Louis. Are you staying at Francie's?
The waiter arrived with their succulent, garlicky-smelling snails. Smoke took one look and made a face.
Try them. You'll like them.
I don't eat anything that crawls on its belly and leaves a trail of slime behind.
Smoke, my friend, you must become more worldly. Escargot are a delicacy.
Sally squashes them when they show up in her garden.
These are raised on clean sand and fed only the best lettuce and other vegetable tops.
They're still snails.
Well, suit yourself.
With the tiny silver fork, he plucked the mollusk from its shelter. Tentatively, Smoke reached for the tongs and clamped them on a snail shell.
Ah, you have joined the sophisticates. Enjoy. Now, in answer to your question, no, I am staying at Ralston's palace.
I haven't taken a room, but I think one of us should stay at Francie's. The trash that showed up might come back.
Since you own it now, it sounds reasonable to me that it is you who stays there, mon ami. I'll meet you there in the morning.
Make it early. The way I see it, we have a lot to accomplish.
When they had finished the lemon gelato, Louis Longmont offered to accompany Smoke Jensen back to the bordello. Smoke gladly accepted. He enjoyed the company of his friend. Their route took them past the pagoda gateway that marked the entrance to Chinatown. Beyond it, a dark alley mouth loomed. They had just barely passed it when the men in black pajama-like clothes attacked. Tong hatched word in the moonlight, striking a myriad of colors from the cheerful lanterns bobbing in the light onshore breeze behind Smoke and Louis. Both gunfighters had been walking their horses and now mounted swiftly. Chinese gangsters soon discovered that their tong hatchets might well strike terror into the merchants of Chinatown, but they proved no match for blazing six guns in the hands of the two best gunfighters in the West.
Shit, that was easy.
Yeah, the Chinamen are all smoke and mirrors. Pull a piece and they tuck tail and run pretty quickly. But where did they come from?
I'd say the alley behind us. I believe we can safely say you heard the right of it about the tongs.
Why's that?
They don't even know I'm in town. You're the one who's been asking questions around San Francisco.
I see what you mean, mon ami.
Shall we go to Francie's?
Hadn't we better report this to the police?
If the police haven't showed by now, I imagine they'd already know and don't want to get involved. We'll leave these here for whoever wants them.
Fresh ground Arabica beans usually made the day for Silas Murchison. This morning, his coffee tasted bitter in his mouth, though. The reason was the presence of Titus Hobson and Gaylord Huntley in his breakfast room. This and the news they brought. The news came in the form of Zhang Wai Li. The slight-statured Chinese could barely suppress his fury.
The first time we are to perform a service for you, we are sent out against men of inhuman capability. You told us that Louis Longmont was a fop, a dandy, a gambler, an easy target. Not so. Then there was the other man with him, such speed and accuracy with a firearm.
Who is that?
What does it matter? Only two of the men sent after Longmont and his companion survived the encounter.
That doesn't answer my question. Who is this other man?
My two soldiers who lived informed me that Longmont used the word smoke as though it was a name.
Oh, he still can't be alive.
Who?
Smoke Jensen. He's reputed to be the best gunfighter who ever lived if he's still alive. Gentlemen, we have a major problem on our hands.
Preposterous.
Well, he's killed more men and maimed more men than any other three shooters you can name. His name is legend in Colorado. When I was last there, Smoke Jensen had devastated a force of 40 men who hunted him through the mountains for a month. It was they who died, not Jensen. He's been an outlaw and a lawman. I mean, there's some who say that he has backshot many men he's killed. Now, personally, I don't believe that. I also heard that to say so to his face, it's get yourself dead real quick. He's mean and wild and totally savage. He's lived with the Indians. He was raised by another total barbarian, a mountain man named Preacher. The pair struck terror into the hearts of men in the mountains for years.
What impact can a couple of aging gunfighters have on our project? If your men cannot handle this, Tyrone Beale and his railroad detectives can take care of a mere two men, no matter that they are good with their guns. Now get out of here, all of you, and let me finish my breakfast.
Smoke Jensen punched back his chair from the round oak table in the breakfast nook of the DeLong Mansion. Frilly lace curtains hung over the parries of the bay window, with plump cushions on the bench seats under them. This excess of the feminine touch made Smoke a bit uneasy. If he kept the place, there was going to have to be some changes. No, hell, that was going to be out of the question. Sally would be bound to find out, and when she did, she would skin him alive. Amusement touched Smoke's lips as he recalled the time Sally had herself inherited a bordello from a favorite aunt who had passed away. That and a big ranch that stood in the way of the ambitions of powerful, greedy men who needed some lessons in manners. And Smoke Jensen had given those lessons, with fatal results. No, Sally would never favor him owning a bawdy house. Lucy Clover's entrance banished the images of the past.
Mr. Longmont is here, Smoke.
Thank you, Lucy. Have Ophelia show him in. Join us. We have a little strategy to discuss.
Oh?
Yes, about protection for this establishment, among other things.
Lucy left him alone to return with Louis Longmont.
Bonjour, mon ami.
Oui, c'est très bon.
They must have fed you well. What is in order for today?
First, we must make provisions for someone to protect this place.
You think there'll be trouble?
Count on it. And we can't stay here all the time. Now that I own this place, I want to make sure all of you are safe.
You make it sound ominous.
Believe me, it is.
Ophelia appeared in the doorway.
There's a nasty-looking group of men at the front door.
How many?
There's about a dozen, Mr. Smoke.
I'll take care of it, Louis.
If you say so, mon ami.
This way, Mr. Smoke.
At the door, Smoke quickly counted the 12 men standing in a semicircle at the foot of the porch steps in three ranks. Several of them held stout hickory pick handles. Tyrone Beale, who had returned only that morning on the early train, acted as a spokesman this time.
Tell those girls that they're to be out of here within half an hour. This place has been sold for back taxes, and the new owner, the California Central Railroad, wants immediate occupancy.
After seeing all the books and ledgers on Francie's establishment the previous day in Pullen's office, Smoke Jensen knew that there were no back taxes.
I have some bad news for you, whoever you are.
Captain Tyrone Beale of the Railroad Police. I'm not interested in any news you might have. I set out, they go, and that's what I mean.
The bad news, Captain Beale, is that you are a liar. All taxes have been paid up through next year. I'm the owner now, so you had best back off so no one gets hurt.
Goaded by the insult, Beale launched himself at Smoke. The remaining men all glared at Smoke and slowly closed the circle around him.
Louis, would you like to join the dance?
I would be delighted.
The men stared open-mouthed at the man on the porch who had put three shots squarely between the legs of the three men leading the attack. Their advance came to a sudden standstill.
Drag this trash off my property, and don't bother to come back.
Satisfied with the results, Smoke and Louis turned to walk back in the mansion. Enraged at this ignominious defeat, Tyrone Beale would not leave it alone.
What's the matter with you? Finish them off! Kill the bastards!
Instantly, the two gunfighters turned to meet the threat.
Hey, Beale, take this garbage out of here. You would be smart not to report this to the police. We have a building full of witnesses who saw what happened. If your boss wants to verify what I said about the taxes and owning this place, he can check with Lawyer Pullen. Oh, and don't bother coming back.
Men quickly left the property.
Now that we have finished our post-breakfast exercise, what's next?
Easy. We look into this tong business from last night and find some reliable men to guard this place while we're gone.